Hey everyone, welcome to the Front Judge Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Albino. Now in a moment, I'll be joined by my colleague at Front Judge, Mike Neff, as we break down a wild and wet weekend of racing at Daytona, which saw Justin Haley and Spire Motorsports get the victory in a rain-delayed cup race, pulling off what we believe to be as the biggest upset in NASCAR history, and you could probably even argue sports history. We'll dig into that, the big one, blocking, and it's incredible Xfinity race, and then also some quotes that Steve Phelps had on the 2021 schedule, as well as the current rules package. And then again, don't forget to listen to our interview with Bob Levine, which came out Wednesday. Bob goes in great depth for 30 minutes or so on Levine Family Racing's 2019 season, how he and Matt DiBenedetto originally paired up, his current relationship with former driver Casey Kane, the 2020 lineup, and much more. But before we get started, make sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the Front Judge Podcast on Apple Podcasts, as those ratings help us out tremendously. Now let's talk Daytona with Neff. All right, Neff, we're so fired up that we decided to do an instant analysis podcast here at Front Judge. Unfortunately, you guys won't hear it till Thursday, but Neff, this was an entertaining race from start to finish. Unfortunately, it was cut short 33 laps, but Neff, I would say, and you might agree, this is probably the biggest upset in NASCAR history with Justin Haley and Spire Motorsports, an agency, a sport agency, coming out on top.
It's right up there, brother. If it's not the biggest, it's top two. Because, yeah, I mean, it's basically Jay Robinson Racing putting old cars together to go out and run. And, you know, Matt Weaver called it a cash grab. The owners of Spire are trying to say it's not, but I mean, you look at it, they're running back of the pack. Their average finish, you told me before we went on air, was like 32.5 over the first 16 races of the year. I mean, they're not out here contending for wins. They're not out here contending for top 20s, and to pull it off is just ridiculous. But it all came down to a split-second decision. And I hate I wasn't in Daytona to ask Justin about it because I didn't hear anybody ask him, but they were coming to one to go with lightning that had been in the area, but there hadn't been any for a while. And so NASCAR got on the radio and said, we're coming to one to go. And all of the teams that had stayed out and not pitted when the caution first flew for the giant wreck, basically came down pit lane, and at the very last second, Haley took a right turn and stayed out. And by the time they got out of turn two, there was lightning again, and they threw the yellow, and they waited out lightning for a bit, and then we had a Mon freaking soon blow through, and looking at the radar, looked like it was going to carry on for hours, so they decided to call it. And by golly, it's better to be lucky than good sometimes. And Haley had a race taken away from him in Xfinity last year at Daytona, and he had one land squarely in his lap this time around.
Yeah, this is sweet redemption for Haley, because like you just said, last year he made a move to the inside of, it was Elliott Sadler and Kyle Larson, coming off of turn four down the front stretch in the Xfinity race, and he dipped below the yellow line, but he had already passed in our opinion.
He was already passed him, yeah. That's why I still argue that was a bogus call.
But you know, for that, if you have to trade that for a cup win the following year, I'm taking that. I'm fine with that.
That's a fair trade.
Especially for Spire Motorsports, though, because, you know, like we were talking about, an average finish of 32.5, Neff, through the first 17 races. And you got to remember that the Spire Motorsport history isn't long. They took out, I think you said it was a $6 million loan to start this team, to buy the charter from Furniture Row, which obviously did a lot with that charter, making the championship three of the past 4 years. But you look at this team, and it's a very small team, a family-run team, with the alliance of Jay Robinson as well, Premium Motorsports. But their best finish this year was in the Daytona 500 prior today with a 22nd from Jamie McMurray. Now, that was a full-pledged Chip Ganassi Racing car.
Yes.
So outside of that, their best finish is by Quinn Huff, 28th in the Coca-Cola 600. And that race was a melee. There's a lot of crashes, so they're lucky to avoid it all and finish 28th. This is mind-boggling. It's mind-blowing. I'm struggling to put it into words because He had 1,000-to-1 odds, Neff. That was the odds in Vegas. If someone bet money on Justin Haley, they made a big chunk of change today.
Well, I mean, don't forget, Leicester, whatever it was called, won the Premier League a couple of years ago, and they were 5,000-to-1 or something at the beginning of their season. So upsets happen, and you know it's going to happen most likely at a super speedway, because when it does, you end up with a big one. And that's what we had today, where you had, you know, 80% of the cars that legitimately were expected to have a chance to win were taken out in a big wreck. And a couple others were taken out before that. So you only had one or two guys left that were really front runners that were even going to have a chance if we went back to green. So it was a strange development, to say the least. And I honestly was sad to see Matt DiBenedetto not get a chance to get back after it. Because if you saw, they didn't talk about it on TV until rain delay, but watching him drive through that wreck and not get caught up, especially when Truex was coming back down the track, and at the last minute DiBenedetto swerved left and missed him, was, I mean, and he told you himself, it was pure luck. You know, the spotter's yelling to go down, so he did, and he just barely missed him. But I felt like it was going to be a real chance for him to come through and get that win. I feel bad, like we talked before this, for Kurt Busch, because they made the call. He had some damage, but they made the call to stay out, and it was going to be a brilliant call. They decided to give him one to go, and then poof, rain comes or lightning comes, and they end up losing the thing. So, I mean, it was a perfect storm. There was a whole bunch of stuff that all lined up, and you ended up having a team that had zero chance of winning this race, barring some total unforeseen, just ludicrously go on, and that's what happened.
For sure. I know last year, after UMBC beat Virginia in the NCAA tournament the first round, it was the first time a 16 seed beat a 1 seed. And at that, you know, that week of the podcast, we rolled off kind of, you know, between you, myself, Zach Tanzaretti, who we thought was the biggest upset. This is up there, man. And we talked about that. I think it's the biggest, as I mentioned. But you look, you know, you mentioned the big wreck, and we'll get into that here in a little bit. But the first 23 cars in the finishing order led a combined 16 laps in this race. Kind of crazy, because you had Austin Dillon, Joey Logano really dominate the race. Austin Dillon had a really fast car. And we'll get into this Chevrolet versus Ford alliance between the, you know, each individual manufacturer, which was also kind of mind-blowing that they were so cooperative together, which is something, you know, we've seen a lot in the past, more so since the 2016 Daytona 500 when Toyota whipped everybody's ass and then had a photo finish. But, man, this was a wild race from start to finish because, you know, the race was obviously cut short 33 laps, but rain was approaching the area at Daytona with about, I don't know, 15, 20 to go in stage two. And right. Obviously once stage two finishes, it's complete. The race is deemed official should rain come, should weather come, lightning, whatever. So the intensity, I mean, it was there all race, but it really picked up with about, I don't know, 10 to go in stage two or whatever.
Yeah. And if you watch the race, the team cooperation was fantastic until those storm clouds formed. And then when you started seeing that it was go time, because getting to the end of stage two may mean you won the race, all of a sudden all that teamwork crap was out the window. And you had three different manufacturers in the top five, and dudes were swapping out and pushing whoever they could push to get to the front. So it sounded like a great idea, but when push came to shove and it got down to the end, it was time to go, and it did not matter. And the end was just a lot sooner because of the threat of weather. And I'll throw this silliness out there because I always do. I still don't understand why we don't run on ovals in rain. Put the rain tires on them, let's go. Everybody always tells me these stories about how it would be too hard on the right front tire and they would blow out and they would fail and all this garbage. Prove it to me. Let's go run Daytona in the rain and see what happens. Because I think it would be phenomenal.
Yeah, I think it'd be a shit show, quite honestly. But, hey, I don't think they'll ever do that. I know they probably won't. I think you know that,
they
too.
They never will. They're all pansies.
Quote from Mike Neff. But, you know, we have a lot to talk to because this was an entertaining race.
Oh, yeah.
And if you ever, it doesn't matter if it's a super speedway track, an oval, a road course, it doesn't matter. If there's a threat of weather in the area, intensity picks up, especially after stage two, because, you know, once it rains, it's the race is probably over. So, you know, very entertaining race really throughout. The whole first stage was good. Three wide racing, Dale Jr. losing his mind in the booth, which was great. I love the, you know, raw emotion. But hey, man, upsets happen, and that's what happened today. That could have been anyone else. Landon Castle was in front of Haley, and he decided to pit. There was a, I mean, behind Kurt, you know, when he elected to pit, there's two or three more cars between him and Haley.
Yep.
And ultimately, Haley, Peter Suspenso, they all made the right call. So, hey, kudos to Justin Haley for picking up that first victory at the cup level.
Absolutely. Yeah, there was one little stretch, and I'm trying to remember. I want to say it was after the pit stops in the first stage, although it may have been beginning of second stage, where it turned into a single-file parade at the top.
Right.
And it lasted for, I don't know, 12 or 15 laps. And then all of a sudden, a bunch of Chevys got on the bottom and started rolling towards the front. And they got to about fourth, and that all broke up. And then the guys on the top dove to the bottom, and we had a two-wide race again. But for the vast majority of this race, it was at least two wide. And once we got past stage two, it was pretty much three wide the rest of the race, which ultimately is why we ended up having a gigantic wreck. But it was, yeah, I mean, it's, is an entertaining race. In all honesty, and I know some people like it, some people hate it, but I think the tapered spacer rather than a plate makes these super speedway races better because there's more throttle response. And lifting isn't a death sentence. It's not good, and it can hurt you for a while, but with a plate, if you lifted, you were going all the way to the back.
Right.
Now you lift, you may go back to 10th or 12th, and you still have the chance to make up some ground pretty quickly. So I like what I've seen out of it so far. Do I love it? No. I'm still a champion for taking the spoilers all the way off these things. I think that'd be even better. But to quote Mark Martin, he saw it today, cars that are hard to handle make for better racing. And the cars today were hard to handle.
For sure. And I think a lot of that has to do with it being hot, a hot July day in Daytona. Obviously, you know.
Shocking.
Yeah, right.
Daytime racing is better than nighttime racing. Where have I heard that before?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, had the race not got postponed from Saturday, Sunday, do we see this racing? It's hard to say, honestly, because we haven't seen this package at night yet. I don't know. But regardless, Neff, a lot of things I want to talk about still, because this is a wild race. We mentioned the big one. Huge crash. Officially, there was 19 cars, but it seemed like the whole field, because
yeah, it was a lot.
It happened coming off the tri-oval, going down into turn one, when Austin Dillon got a huge run for the lead. I forget who he passed. Might have been Logano. No, it wasn't Logano. I'm not sure. Can't remember off the top of my head, but he got a huge run. Got by Chase, then split someone else, got to the lead. Bowyer followed him, and then ultimately Bowyer went to make a move because he got another big run, who I believe Logano was pushing, and you know, Bowyer or Dillon went to block him, and it looked like a block initially, and then he got hit, and then he was out of control, kept coming left, and then melee. What's your take on that? That's obviously, you know, we see a lot of big ones, especially at Daytona because it's so narrow, but just a bummer deal for all involved.
Yeah, I mean, anytime you get guys fighting for the lead that wreck, it's going to be big. I mean, it's that simple. And that's why it was so amazing when Keselowski got taken out that it wasn't bigger.
Yeah.
I really, when he turned right, I thought that was going to be huge, and it was amazing it wasn't. But I don't know that we'll ever know for sure. I'm sure somebody can probably throw it in a wind tunnel and do some sort of analysis or something, but I don't think Bowyer touched Dillon. He was darn close to him, and as he swept across that back end, it upset the rear of the car, loosened him to the right, so he was chasing it down the track. And I think at that point, Bowyer got next to him, which piled air in the left rear wheel well, which turned him more to the left again, and he was still trying to fight it to get it back to the right, and it just, he could never get off of it. So I honestly think it was a racing deal. You know, you would hope that when Clint went and he started to get out of shape, Dylan could have saved it and got away from him. But for whatever reason, it was like he was stuck to him. And it drug him all the way down until it turned him. And then once it turned him, Bowyer went up the track. And that was the end. And once you had somebody going back up the track in front of all of those cars, it was over. And people could just never get checked up. I mean, the brakes aren't big enough on these things. And even if they were, I don't think it would have mattered. But you had total track blockage at a couple different times, and yet Dylan and DiBenedetto and somebody else, I never could see the car number, came through on the bottom.
McDowell.
And was that who went underneath?
Yeah, he was hauling ass. Yeah.
When I first saw it, I thought it was one of those archetype deals where the guy just didn't lift and just came flying through there and got lucky. But when I watched the replay later, he had checked up as much as DiBenedetto did, and when he saw an opening, he gassed up and passed him. So it was a good move. When I first saw it, I thought it was really stupid. But in slow motion, I changed my opinion and gave him kudos because he got it through there. But, I mean, it's super speedway racing when you get down to it. And when you get to the end of these shows, if you haven't had five or six incidents that have kind of thinned the field a little bit, you're going to end up with bigger wrecks at the end because you've got that many more guys with a chance to win, and they're going to take those chances, and one of them's going to fail. And if it happens at the front, it grabs a whole bunch of them.
Yeah, and especially when you're three wide. I mean, that takes a lot of concentration for most of the race. We saw the same thing at Talladega. You know, there's a lot of drama late, a lot of incidents, but until lap, you know, until 85 or so, when Keselowski and Harvick got together, went into the outside wall, that thinned the field down a little bit because you had Keselowski, Reagan, who took a big hit, Suarez was out, and Harvick was obviously non-competitive after that. But you still had like 36 cars or so in the lead draft. So, you know, some of them might have been slower than in state lagging back like we see at super speeder races.
I honestly felt like DiBenedetto and Bubba Wallace both did that. I was looking for them early in the race, and I really didn't see them at all in the first two stages. And then when it got down to go time there in the third stage, all of a sudden Bubba and Matt were both at least appearing in the frame of the front of the pack.
Right.
And it seemed to me like they kind of just played it smart. And Haley admitted he does the same thing because they don't have the equipment to go out and do that. They didn't test any kind of drafting at all in practice. And he was riding out near the back, and that's ultimately what saved him.
Yeah, I was listening to his post-race media availability in the press, in the media center, and they were 27th before the big crash. So, I mean, you know, you go from 27th to first in a few laps because you stay out. I mean, ultimately you got the win, and that's obviously the end goal. And
technically, for the second year in a row, the winner of this race only led the last lap.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, this was a wild race from start to finish. And I feel like we got robbed 33 laps because I feel like with the guys you had remaining, I mean, we were going to have a surprise winner. I truly believe.
We were going to have a surprise winner, and I think we were going to see some crazy stuff because all of a sudden you've got DiBenedetto and Corey LaJoie and Justin Haley and Ty Dillon and guys that aren't normally competing for wins looking around going, dude, we could win a race. And all of a sudden, things get exciting when you have a legit, true chance to win a race.
Yeah, out of the top 20 finishing positions, Kyle Busch was the only driver that had won a race, and he finished 14th this year. So, yeah, we were going to get a surprise winner, whether it was William Byron or Jimmy Johnson. I feel like it probably would have been one of those two because they didn't have much damage to their respective cars. But you had Newman up there, who got his first top five in 59 races since Talladega 2017 in the fall race. Ty Dillon got a career best finish of 4th Neff. It's Jermaine Racing's. This is ironic. Second career top five. Both have come in July rain-shortened races at Daytona.
Nice.
And the last was in 2014 with Casey Mears. William Byron got his first top five. It's crazy with how fast he's been. Today was his first top five finish in second. Jimmy Johnson bettered last week's position by one. Got his best finish since the spring Bristol race last year. I mean, this was a surprising race.
Yeah, you had a bunch of dudes. And again, it's all because of the giant wreck. But even then, it was nice to see movement of the top lane and the bottom lane. There were a handful of guys that seemed to be able to make some moves without anybody helping them. Chase Elliott and Joey Logano come to mind. Both of them seemed to be able to make passes by themselves, which we didn't see. We don't see a lot of at these tracks. It was weird at the beginning when Denny and Kyle hooked up like old school tandem racing for three laps. But like they said on the broadcast, I think Kyle was dragging a brake in order to keep them hooked together so that they couldn't really just take off. But at one point there, Harvick was like, to heck with this, and got on, I think it was Logano's bumper, and just pushed him way out in the lead. It was like, we can do this too, but he didn't stay locked up with him near that long.
I'm surprised Hamlin didn't overheat, because we haven't seen tandem racing in a long time. And, and granted, they were tandeming, but they were still in the, you know, they got to the lead maybe once or twice in the first, I think it was first seven laps there, pretty much hooked together, right on the outside there. I was surprised he didn't overheat, because back in the day, you'd have to switch every few laps in order to make it work. So
yeah, I don't know if they had it, how they had his radiator taped up or whatever, because he was sliding out to the right, so the right front was catching some air, that maybe they had something hooked up from that side of the radiator opening to pull the air into the radiator to help cool it. But I agree. We never saw somebody do that long of a tandem without overheating, but he did it without any problem.
And a few other notes. Corey LaJoie got a career best sixth. Matt Tift a career best ninth. J.J. Haley got his best finish since the 2013 Daytona 500. I mean, these are a lot of stats, you know, that you really don't see, you know, outside of super speedway tracks. But, hey, man, good day for the little guys.
Yeah, man.
Because they're going to, you know, the prize money.
Now we can go to Kentucky and watch Martin Truex lead 300 laps again.
Yeah, and you'll see the 77, who I believe Quinn Huff is driving next week. They'll probably finish in the 30s. I mean, that's just the way it is. This is so wild. I can't get over it. Now, a few more talking points. This manufacturer alliance, I guess I'll call it, Toyota, I guess not really Toyota, but Chevrolet's working with just Chevrolet's, Ford's just working with Ford's. Chevrolet had this down path at Talladega. They dominated the race, swept all three stages, led a ton of laps. And if you look back to last year,
I say, don't forget Ford did it last year with Stewart Haas.
Yeah, and that's where I'm going. At Talladega, Stewart Haas, I mean, those four cars pulled away from the field by like 8 seconds. Just those four cars late in the race until there was a late caution. Probably would have finished top four had there not been some fuel issues towards the end. You know, what's your opinion on this? Because, you know, it's hard to get. There's 16 Fords, 18 Chevrolets. I like the analogy Steve Letarte gave on the broadcast. That's like, you know, to make this work, to work all together, that's like getting 15 of your friends and going out to eat together.
To go out to eat.
Yeah, and, I mean, plans change. You know, you don't want to do what's best for someone else. Technically, I wouldn't if I was a race car driver. You want to win. What are your thoughts on this?
The one part of Letarte's analogy that was wrong is you try to get 15 friends to go out to eat and they're all paying the bill. Chevy and Ford were picking up the tab on this deal.
That's true.
So when they're picking up the tab, you'll go wherever they tell you you're going to go for dinner. And that was especially Chevy's point. They said they talked to all the owners and all the drivers and basically said, look, we are your number one sponsor. That, yes, you've got the money coming in from your normal car sponsors, but we're sinking more money into this than any of those guys are. So you're going to make sure that you do everything you can to get us up front. And as I said before, that's all well and good until the rubber hits the road and it's time to get the trophy. And then you go with who works. And I mean, we saw that at one point in there relatively early on, even that eventually Hamlin left Kyle out to dry because he was just like, I'm not, my car is not comfortable trying to push him. And so as much as he had told people he wasn't good on the bottom, he went to the bottom because he felt even less comfortable behind Kyle at the top. So it works at these tracks. We'll be curious to see if it starts doing it at mile and a half tracks, because again, you've got the same horsepower. So theoretically, if they wanted to, I would think that manufacturers could kind of gang up at some of these mile and a half tracks or the 2 mile track and maybe make this work as well. But in the end, racers are racers and they're going to go for a win. That's why I get such a kick out of people last week talking about the fact that it was in the fix for Bowman to win that race because he needs a sponsor and NASCAR wanted to see him win. And I would love to see some of these people go in the garage and try to tell 37 or 35 other teams, hey, you guys are going to get beat this week because we want to make sure this other team can get a sponsor. They may say, oh yeah, sure, no problem, till they get on the track. You've got a whole garage full of type A personalities that are not laying down for anybody. And there's no way that anybody is going to lay down and let somebody else win unless it's like true team orders. And that's where, I mean, Friday night, Colleague had the top three. Yeah, second and third may have been able to step out and try to make a move on Ross at the end, but in reality, they knew it was going to be a 1-2-3 for Colleague, and the best chance they had of it was staying in line from turn four all the way to the finish line. So if it's a team thing like that, maybe you get some guys that'll lay down. But I promise you, if that race on Friday had gone five more laps, AJ Allmendinger's winning that race. Because he was passing a car at least every lap, if not every other lap, for the last 15 laps of that race.
For sure. Well, we'll get into that here in a little bit.
I know we will. I get ahead of myself.
But yeah, the whole Chevrolet Alliance, and I mean, they've really, for a long time, from like, I don't know, the Talladega 2016 spring race, I think, on, for like 2 years straight, Ford was dominant on the super speedway tracks. They won like seven straight races. And they had shown that, you know, the alliance between the teams can work, or the manufacturer. But this year, it's been to a whole new level. And you know, you see it in practice. You know, they all come out together. It was really cool. Daytona 500 practice, final practice on Saturday. I was standing right near Daniel Suarez's garage stall, and it's almost like they blew a whistle, and then all the Ford guys had already took off together. And, you know, they went out to pit road and off onto the track. It's so crazy how you just have to be selfless in order to make it work. And yeah, like you said, these guys are type A personalities. You're telling me that Matt DiBenedetto, who's with Toyota, granted, they only have six cars and only he was the real one that didn't have damage on it, is going to lay over for Kyle Busch, push Kyle Busch to the victory when he doesn't have a win? Or even a Ryan Newman, who finished fifth, push Eric Almirola to the winner or something, you know, like that, who I don't see it happening. All gloves are off. And I think Ford showed that in the first stage when they helped each other until the last lap. And then it was kind of game on.
Yeah, and that's what I was alluding to earlier. They'll play friends and play nice until it's time to get the check. And then all bets are off because they're racers. And I shouldn't even say check. Trophy is a thing because half these guys don't even get the check when they win.
Or even stage one.
They get the trophy and they get those stage points. And that playoff point is a big deal. So there's no doubt that they will, you know, they're going to do whatever they can to finish in front of the guy in front of them when the checkered flag is coming out, whether it's black and white or green and white. So that's just the nature of racers. I've never met a racer that was happy to see somebody else win.
Same. And I wonder, like at the end of the first stage, when Harvick, it looked like he was going to win the stage, and then Joey Logano got this big run. He got a shove from someone, can't remember right now, but it was a Ford driver who was in third, and Logano got by for the win. I'm curious if Harvick thought that was coming. Because, you know, Edsel Ford and these guys, they sit down, you know, top people at Ford, and they want what's best for the company, and you know, they had a great first stage or whatever, but I don't know. I'd like to be a fly on the wall in those team meetings, the manufacturer meetings.
I'd like to be a fly on the wall this week.
Yeah, right.
After all of those calls, and find out how they felt about the end of stage two, when there was everybody helping everybody, and there was no team orders going on over the last five or six laps of that second stage.
True. Besides, you had Dylan, Bowman, Byron, and Chase lined up, but I mean, Bowyer, yeah, you're right. Bowyer made a big run, and he was getting pushed by maybe Stenhouse, but behind that, there were Chevrolets, and, you know, they made it up to the lead, and then ultimately in the final two or three laps, they fell back, and Bowyer finished fifth in the stage. But you're right, you know, team orders were kind of off with five to go or so.
Absolutely.
It's just the super speedway racing, the evolution of it is kind of, I don't know. I mean, do you like it? Do you like the way this is right now?
Like I said, I'm enjoying it more because of the fact that there's throttle response. And I feel like that's making a difference. You know, it's our second time with this package on a super speedway. Daytona was a different package the first time through. So we've had this package at Talladega and now back at Daytona. So as these teams figure it out, it'll evolve and it'll change. And ultimately, it'll probably get back to what it was with plates. But I at least having some throttle response, I think, makes a difference and gives drivers a few more options instead of just being mad at all the time, because if you aren't mad and you're going backwards. So for now, yeah, I like it. I mean, we've seen it twice, and I think the racing's been pretty good both times. So let's be cautiously optimistic as we head to Talladega in the playoffs.
It's entertaining for sure.
Yeah, which we learned this week. That is the important thing. Even if it's going to be lousy racing, as long as it's entertaining, we're going to stick with it.
I mean, and I said this after the Talladega, the spring race in April. It reminds me of mid-2000s when Dale Jr. was dominating and DEI and Tony Stewart and Jr. won, what, five straight races at Talladega. That's what this reminds me of, this package. I feel like it's most similar to that. Would you agree or no?
I don't know, because see, that back then DEI had such dominance.
True.
And I don't feel like, I mean, I feel like the Penske's are probably the class of the field, but at the same time, they weren't up front all day, and it was really only Logano that truly looked really strong today. He's the one that made that move on Harvick coming back relatively by himself at the end of the first stage. The cars look different.
Yes.
Yeah, they don't have that big snow plow front end on them like the ones did in the 2000s. it's different. I don't know if I'm ready to commit to saying it's 2000. I think it's a new and different package. We'll have to see.
Got it. Now, Neff, there's one other point from the weekend that I want to talk about specifically on the Cup race. If you want to...
Oh, I got all sorts of points.
Yeah, but one that I really want to get into. It all happened in practice. We're talking about practice here, Neff.
Yeah. Not a game.
Practice. And you know where I'm going with this. So final practice comes along. William Byron makes a soft block. It wasn't even really a block. He didn't change.
It was a block.
Yeah, he didn't even change two lanes to block Brad Keselowski. And Keselowski just sent it right through him. Said he's not lifting for anybody, which he did say publicly last year after, ironically enough, he was involved in a crash at the front of the field with Byron. Byron went down to block. Stenhouse gave Keselowski this big run. Keselowski lifted and ultimately got pushed by Stenhouse. Brad was taking no prisoners this weekend. Kind of came back to bite him in the Cup race.
I'm pretty sure Harvick didn't lift.
Yeah. Bowyer didn't lift either to cause the big one. But what's your take on the practice deal? Because I see where Brad's coming from for sure, but to do it in practice, I think, is a little uncalled for.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty weak. I understood his point, and it obviously sent a visible message to everybody where just saying it might not have gotten around to everybody. But at the same time, and I know Byron didn't wreck the car, but they still had to go to a backup.
Hell of a save.
So that was disappointing. Yeah, again, it's practice. We don't need to be tearing up cars in practice. If he made the block and you didn't like it, get out of your car, go down to his stall and talk to him. Be like, look, dude, you screwed me at Daytona. You're screwing me again today. If you get in front of me again, I'm going to dump you. And word will spread from that. It may not get to everybody, but it'll spread. And then people will be looking out for it. And as it plays out during the race, it plays out during the race. These cars take so much time and effort and money to prepare, especially for super speedway races, that tearing them up is just, it's almost insulting to the guys that work on them.
Right.
And I hate to see that happen.
And Brad's been there. He's worked on his own cars for a lot of, you know, the early part of his career for sure. When he, I hate to say it, but was really a nobody. You know, he impressed Dale Jr., which got him into that 88 ride. And then, yes, Brad's made the most of that opportunity, and he's become a somebody. He's a cup champion. So I think the move was personally uncalled for. Hell of a save by Byron, not to cause even a bigger crash. And you talk about team orders. I mean, right behind Keselowski was his teammates. So that, I mean, doing that, there's risk. There's risk that Byron's going to crash. He's going to crash into you, and you're going to make a huge pileup, which, you know, is drafting practice. So, just uncalled for, in my opinion, when it comes to practice. But maybe that was the best time to do it, because there isn't many cars around, and you're sending a message, which I think that's where Brad's mindset is coming from.
Yep. I understood what he was trying to accomplish. I feel like there was probably a better way to do it.
And you look, you know, I looked up Brad's stats. Since he won at Daytona in 2016, his best finish is 12th, which was in the 500 this year, I think, and his average finish is 29.5. And we tout Brad, and he is one of the best super speedway racers in all of NASCAR, maybe ever, because I would say he's the best since Dale Jr., and maybe Dale Sr., honestly. He just, the stuff he can do inside of a car, the blocks he makes. Granted, he doesn't have Joey Meyer this year as a spotter, but it's still, you know, once he gets out front, he's entertaining to watch block the lines. And
he and Logano both.
Yeah, for sure.
I think those two are probably the two best super speedway racers we have in the sport right now.
Agreed. All right, now, if you said you had a lot of points to bring up, so lay them on me.
Where was the competition caution? I asked it before it happened. There was a tweet that came out from Bob Pockrass that said Steve O'Donnell, vice chairman of competition, I believe is his title, and Twitter friend to all media types.
Yep.
Made the comment that they took a poll among crew chiefs who decided they didn't need one because of the fact that they could not make it to the end of the first stage without a fuel stop. Okay. I'm pretty sure if they take a poll of all their crew chiefs, they'd like to have bigger holes in their tapered spacers. And they'd like to have smaller spoilers. And they'd like to have narrower cars and lower roofs and all sorts of other stuff that's in the rule books that they can't have. Since when do we officiate the races based on the opinions of the majority of the crew chiefs? I don't understand it. Again, they speak out of both sides of their mouth about safety. We're concerned about the safety. We know we have a green racetrack. I'm glad that there weren't any tire issues before the first stage ended, but when every single competitor came down and did not change tires and ran those tires the whole first stage on a green racetrack, I truly, in all honesty, wanted to see them becoming like to the white flag and have 30 cars blow right fronts and just be like, there you go. You put it in the hands of the crew chiefs, and that's why we don't do that. But that's not what happened. But I'm an anti-competition caution person anyway because I think it's disingenuous. But to say that you decided not to have one because you pulled the crew chiefs and they didn't want to is just demeaning to the entire enforcement of rules in general. I mean, let's take a poll of how many of them think that a tire sitting still in a pit stall is an uncontrolled tire.
Yeah.
I promise we'd get rid of that rule in a hurry. Yeah, it's, I don't know, that just really frustrated me that we're interviewing the crew chiefs and going on majority opinion.
And it frustrated me too, and I feel like I backed you on Twitter for that. It's just the inconsistency, man. Like, what, and we talked about this a lot in the past, it seems like a month or so. What is and what isn't a competition caution? Like, what triggers it? Because it poured in Daytona all weekend. There wasn't a competition caution in the Xfinity race, to my knowledge, off the top of my head. And it poured right before there, before that race. But then you have a whole day where it rains, a whole night. And then, I mean, maybe, I guess you could argue that weather was in the area all day today. And caution laps at Daytona take a while. And you want to obviously get to the end of stage two. But outside of that, yeah, what happened if 30 cars or even two cars blew right front tires in the first stage? I mean, I guess it would have been on them for not taking tires when they decided to pit. But I just, there's got to be a rule. There's rules about everything else. We need a rule about competition cautions and what is and what isn't one, because I don't know, it's kind of sickening. It's sickening to talk about. Like, what? I don't know, Neff. I'm frustrated.
Yeah, again, we all thought we understood that if there's rain, we get a competition caution. Because God knows, we've had some races where there was like heavy dew and they threw a competition caution on it. And then last week, we have rain at Chicago that delays the start of the race. No competition caution. And tires mattered at Chicago.
Oh, yeah.
And this week, we take a poll and they don't have it. And it's, yeah, terribly frustrated at that development.
And,
but,
and ultimately, you saw what happened in Chicago. Four cars did blow right front tires. So, yeah, when you have a green racetrack, doesn't matter whether it's new asphalt or old asphalt. You know, it's going to wear a little bit, at least. And, you know, like Chicago, a lot. So
true. And then my other frustration was earlier in the weekend, they had a, I believe it was a press availability with Steve Phelps talking about the package. Everybody hates to talk about the package. But he made the claim that based on the eyeball test, the racing this year has been extremely exciting, ultra competitive, and that based on responses from the fan council, it is by far appreciated and approved of by the fans, and that they are going to stick with it for the foreseeable future. And that they don't pay attention to Twitter because Twitter is basically full of a bunch of negative Nellies. And I just, again, yes, there are aspects of this package that I appreciate. Same. And it is interesting not having the leader just take off and leave. But when you have a guy who is the leader that ends up in fifth, and he can't get back to the front unless he's a really good side drafter, because just driving and going in deeper and braking doesn't matter because you're on the mat the whole time. That's not, in my opinion, what the top level of the sport should be. The ultimate pinnacle of stock car racing, I think, should require you to use the brakes to make the car turn. And that is how you differentiate the men from the boys. When they get to the corner, the guy that can drive it in deeper and take longer to get on the brakes and get off the brakes faster, to get off the corner faster, that's where you define racing. And just to be able to be a great side drafter doesn't do it for me.
I totally agree with you. I wish that we could argue more on this podcast, but in my opinion, the more horsepower, the better. Yes, there might be a day or a race where a driver hits on something and checks out to a 14-second lead like Truex did a couple years ago at Kentucky, and he probably still will this weekend with the package. But it's because they're good at that track. Yes, this package bunches them up closer or runs them closer together, but, and we've had some good races. There, like you said, there's a lot of aspects that I appreciate from this package. The smaller teams, it does seem like, to a degree, have closed the gap a little bit. Like a Corey LaJoie finishing 12th in the Coke 600. he outran at the end guys like Brian Blaney and bigger teams. So yes, you know, there's room for improvement. We knew that. I wasn't a fan of it coming into the year. I don't think you were either. But I don't know. When you have so many drivers, and I feel like, you know, maybe it's not a good thing always to listen to the drivers, but when they don't like racing the package and are very vocal about it, even if they win a race, like Kyle Busch at Pocono, I feel like something should change. But if you're going to go for it for the foreseeable future, you got to make some sort of change. I don't know. I wish there was more horsepower, ultimately.
Yeah, and the other comment that came out of that was, is full throttle, nonstop racing what we want?
I saw that.
And he said, if that provides the best entertaining races, then yes. And I just, it made me feel like we're WCW or WWE, that we are officially an entertainment business, and be damned the competition we want to put on a show.
Yeah, and there's always been aspects, obviously. I mean, this isn't entertainment.
Sure. I think I've shared this with you at one point in time. Russell Branham was the president of Darlington for a while. And at one point, and I don't remember who the driver was, but they had almost a 2-lap lead on the field. And Russell Branham went up on a spotter stand and grabbed the spotter for whoever it was that was leading and said, if you don't tell him to slow down and get back with the rest of the pack, we will black flag him and hold him for 5 laps to make sure he doesn't win this race.
Good old NASCAR.
Because, you know, there's an entertainment factor or a value, but at the same time, there has to be some skill.
Yeah.
And there's still an ongoing debate on a tweet that I put out that two different Twitter folks have gotten into, and I haven't answered it in a couple, 3 days, but they've been going back and forth about how hard these cars are to drive. And if you talk to any of the drivers, they tell you that they're not. And that the, you know, that their moms and grandmothers could go out there and race them just because it's really not that hard. I think today was an exception. And I talked about that a little bit earlier. I think that today you did have driver ability making a difference just because the cars were unstable. And I don't know if that's because of the increased speed that you get at super speedways to where I harken back to the 70s. And in 1977, GM came out with a body on the Buicks and the Chevys where the back window was almost perfectly straight up and down. And when they went to Daytona the first time with it and they got into packs, they would be driving along and the rear tires on the GM cars would lift off the ground just because of the airflow going over that squared off back window. And they had to make some adjustments in the rules to let them lay that window down a little, even though it didn't match the body templates from the manufacturer. And that may be something that we're seeing on these super speedways, that back spoiler is so big that when you're getting up to the speeds or getting on super speedways, that it's actually lifting the back end a little bit. Maybe, I don't know, but it seems like something is causing these cars to be way looser at Daytona than they have been in several years.
Yeah, that's a fair point. And I thought today's race was great, like we talked about. But when it comes back to the package, you know, I had a conversation with Corey LaJoy at Dover, and it was during the media bullpen. And he mentioned, because the big thing on Friday at Dover, and we talked about this on the podcast the following week, was that how fast the cars were going through the center of the corner. It was 17 miles per hour up than just last year. That's hauling ass around Dover. And so you ask the drivers, yeah, I asked Corey, I'm like, is this too fast? And he looked at me like I was stupid. And he's like, no, we're race car drivers, man up, wheel it, you know, blah, blah, blah. Next week at Kansas, when we're going 165 top speed, that won't be fun. It's comments like that, that, you know, you can tell that there's so much to work with this package. And it has brought some good races. Kansas was a good race. It was a lot slower than the past, but it was a good race. Charlotte, Chicago, Daytona, Talladega. A lot of these have been good races, but it's a work in progress. And, NASCAR will get to work on it. Steve Phelps in his first full year of the job. I think he's done a great job from taking over. A lot more visible at the track than some of the previous people that have run NASCAR to a degree. I think it's the sport's in good hands. And like I said, it's going to be a work in progress.
Yeah, and that was one other point out of that presser that worried me a little bit was that, and he was referring to some answers he'd given earlier in the week about them not making wholesale changes to the schedule. And when they had first talked about it, it sounded like they were going to make some wholesale changes. And now I'm starting to kind of get the inkling or the feeling that more short tracks and road courses is going to translate into Road America in Iowa.
Yeah.
And that's going to be it. And if they just add two tracks and don't change anything else, I don't know that that is the kind of alteration we want to see. I know that's not the alteration I want to see. And I've been a proponent for a long time that every track should only get one race. And there's multiple aspects to that. But my main belief is that the NASCAR Cup Series should be a destination event. And the fact that you give tracks two races during a year diminishes that destination quality. And so you get people like, I can go to the Bristol spring race, but I can also go to the night race. So I'm not going to go to the spring race. And they don't go to both. Where if you're running at, pick a track, Hickory, and you're like, they're coming to Hickory once all year, we got to be there. Or they're coming to Eldora. That's, Eldora truck race, yes, it's dirt and it's cool and it's different and it's a different crowd. But a big reason that that place is so packed out is it's the only opportunity to see the trucks at Eldora all year long.
Right.
And so it's, I agree that I would like to see Daytona keep the Dash Clash, whatever it's called, and Charlotte keep the All-Star race. But other than that, I don't think the track should get two dates. And I think that would spread the wealth more around the country. I think we could get a lot more of a presence in the Northwest where for we don't go at all.
Yeah.
I would love to see us a little more in the Northeast, whether it's Thompson or Stafford or something like that. And different places in the Midwest of the country too. I mean, there's a lot of tracks in this great land of ours that I would love to see us race at. And I see a lot of people pushing back this week about, well, there would have to be a lot of upgrades to be able to handle a cup race. Not necessarily. Why have we gotten spoiled? I mean, that's one of the things that I heard for years, and it doesn't matter as much now because there's not near the amount of hospitality at tracks that there used to be. Mm-hmm. But that was one of the big pushbacks of not going to short tracks was they didn't have the space to handle the required hospitality of a cup race. And I'm like, in the end, you're going for the race. You're not going for the hospitality. And I don't, when I buy a ticket to go see Bristol, I don't factor into my ticket purchase that I'm going to get to bring home a bag full of freebies from all the sponsors out in the parking lot before the race.
Right.
That doesn't matter to me. I don't care who is having an activation at the track. It's nice that they're there, and I appreciate that. But if they're not there, that doesn't affect my ticket buying one way or the other. And that's where I think we kind of lost sight of that. And if we could get back to the mindset that the show is the race and make that race special, we don't need 60,000 seats. We can get by with 20,000 or 10,000. And, we bring in some extra stands at Hickory to where it'll hold 10,000 people. Charge $500 for a ticket, Yeah, people will scream and holler that they're not able to go to that race because it's so expensive. But I bet you over time they'll save up enough so they can make that trip one time.
Right.
And it becomes an event. And I think that's where we need to get with this sport, is to get back to where going to the race is something special. And the support comes from them being events, and people only go to one or two or three races a year instead of 10 or 12. That's one of those things that I think we got spoiled by guys going to 10 or 12 races and filling the stands all the time, and now they've cut back, and nobody else is there to pick up the slack. And I think if we make these races really cool and really special, I think we'll end up having a surge in people going to them because they are unique and different.
That was one of your better rants. It was a long one.
It was a little long, but I'm passionate about it.
I was going to say, very passionate.
I want to see this sport not only survive, but grow again and get new fans out here and get back to where we were in the 90s and early 2000s. And I think it can be done, but we got to break the mold. We got to go back to where the thing started. I don't want it to be Southeast-centric. I want it to be nationwide. But I want us to get back to tracks that are half mile and less, and make it local mom-and-pop type racing rather than these big productions with giant flyovers and a Ferris wheel. How come a Ferris wheel has become a feature at every racetrack?
Yeah, the SMIs.
I don't understand that. I'm like, it's I don't know.
I mean,
it's
to a degree, though, that does make it more of an event, like a family aspect.
It does, having the zone and doing the things. But at the same time, I'm going to the Indianapolis 500. The 100 running of the Indianapolis 500, and they had a concert go on in the infield during the race. During the race.
And they still... I definitely see where you're coming from, but you want to appeal to all masses, right? Like, yes, we're hardcore race fans, have been our whole life. We cover the sport now, but let's be honest. Not everybody likes racing. Probably the majority of people don't. So if you can get people to come to the track, like Indy's done with the Snake Pit, and we're getting real off topic now, but if you do something like that, if each track does something like that, Ty Dillon's been really outspoken about this. Bring more entertainment. You know, have a section of grandstands, you know, on one level, the second level be entertainment, third level, I forget what he said, but he said, you know, he went off on this. He thinks every car should have an onboard camera that you can stream straight to each driver's social media account.
Well, I agree with that.
And there's going to be some changes here coming up. I guess fortunately it won't be for at least another year and a half with 2021, but I don't know. By having like the Ferris wheel or whatever, I think in my opinion it does make it more an event. Even though I agree with you, each track, regardless, maybe a couple, should have just one race. And it does. I mean, that's what happened in New Hampshire. New Hampshire lost a race, and they poured everything into this one race of last year. Yep. And then, yes, they had the big weekend for...
And then they made a big short track weekend the other weekend.
Exactly. And, you know, fans were pissed off. I did a whole article on this, you know, in 2017 when it was announced. The fans were pissed off because they're losing a NASCAR date, a key NASCAR date, in the playoffs. But life goes on, and, you know, we're going to get more... Hopefully we get more short tracks, but enough. That's a year away. Something I want to talk about before, you know, we kind of close this podcast is the Xfinity race. I'm kind of tying this full circle now. Because Colleague Racing, Justin Haley had another good run there. Ross Chastain dominated, leading 49 of the 90 laps. Colleague Racing led 86 of 100 overall. Prior to Friday night's race, they had only led 93 laps and 122 total starts. But their Super Speedway program's been elite, really, since they began as a team. Their first race, the Daytona, the 300-mile race in 2016 with Blake Koch. This was, from start to finish, this was a great race.
Absolutely. I completely agree. And like I said, the most fun I had in that whole race was watching A.J. Allmendinger over the last 15 laps. Because he literally was running 20-something.
Yeah.
And just started picking them off with that textbook dive to the bottom slide job, people, every single lap just about. And it was so fun to watch. I mean, that was really just a cool piece of it. But I agree. I mean, it just, dudes were going after it. But at the same time, And I'm arguing with my boy Corey Latham about this on Facebook. Ross Chastain threw some aggressive blocks. And after the practice incident with Mr. Keselowski this weekend, I feel like if Ross had tried some of those moves in a cup car, he'd have ended up in a fence. Because there were a lot of people that cut him some slack that didn't have to. And if any one of them had decided to not lift, he wouldn't have made it to the end of the race. At the same time, it's fun to watch. And that's why we like these super speedway races, because guys have to throw blocks and they have to take chances, especially near the end, if they're going to win a race. So it was awesome to watch. I keep hoping that if the whole thing can come full circle, and the time comes that Kurt Busch decides to get out of the car, if they'll put Ross Chastain in that number one, that would be sweet justice. Because I think it was going to be great that he was going to be at Ganassi, and I would love to see him get in that one car. But the race itself, there were a lot of guys making some really aggressive moves, and it made for an exciting race. But it was wide open from the drop of the green to the drop of the check.
Yeah, that was one of the better races I've seen in a long time, super speedway or not. Yes, colleague dominated, but, I mean, it came down right to the finish. And, you know, obviously Allmendinger did make a lot of late passes. His car did fail post-race inspection. He was the random, which is another rant we could get into, but we're running long, so maybe we can hold it to next week. Is if we're going to pick two cars, you know, the first two, if we're going to tech them and then tech a random, I feel like every car should get teched. Because if you're doing one out of three, and it's consistent now, it's what, three out of past four weekends, one of the cars NASCAR is teched, has failed. If you're doing one out of three, I mean, that's 12 out of 40, 13 out of 40. So yeah, on average, if you want one out of three, but that would take a long time. The teams wouldn't be happy at all. So it probably won't happen. But if you want to be fair, I guess that would be, you know, let's get into that next week though. This was a good race. You know, you had Christopher Bell finish third. Stephen Lightneff got his first top five in 12 years. Brandon Brown got a career best finish. Jeff Green got a second top 10 of the year. The first time he's done that since.
That was amazing.
Yeah, he's a hell of a super speed racer. His first time he's got at least two top 10s in the same year since 2002. Matt Mills, a career best 10th. Vinnie Miller, 11th. Stephen Parsons, 12th in his first race. This is, I mean, yes, there's a lot of good racing, but hey, the small teams came to play again.
They did, and we all know how that goes. And the great equalizer of super speedway racing. But Jeff Green, I mean, that dude is the king of Start and Park. And when they let him go on these plate tracks, it's fun to watch, and it's great to see. And I mean, I'm old school Jeff Green fan. I'm from back in the early 2000s when he was driving for PPC Racing in the Nesquik number 10, before Scott Riggs ever got in that car. And he destroyed the Busch Series for a year. I mean, annihilated it in that car. And I've enjoyed watching him the last, I don't know, 15 years or so running summer shootout races, being out there with his family in a Legends car mixing it up, because he hasn't been able to mix it up that much on Sundays and on Saturdays. So I was really happy to see him be able to get out there and show his stuff and prove that he can still wheel it. And again, Stephen Parsons, man, I'm trying to remember how long ago it was. It was a fall before last that he broke his ankle at Myrtle Beach Speedway. And to see him getting a shot, not to mention his first ever shot, is at Daytona. Again, I feel like the handlers of these guys might want to rethink some of this sometimes, but they gave him that shot, and man, did he capitalize. He ran a really smart race, stayed out of trouble, and was there at the end. And that's what you want from your driver at a super speedway.
Yeah, and he didn't find out until Wednesday of last week that he was even racing. So
he was under the car working.
Yeah,
he works, and said, hey, you're going to be driving this.
Yeah, he works for BJ McLeod during the week, so good run for him. Going back to Jeff Green, this weekend at Kentucky Neff is his last race of the year because he'll be having rotator cuff surgery, which is a good transition into Kentucky because we've been running long. But Neff, we got a triple header this weekend. Obviously, since we're recording this right after the race on Sunday, we don't have a full entry list, but I feel like we do have an idea of who will be good. Who you got winning this weekend?
Oh, goodness. Trucks. I'm going to go with my man, Grant Enfinger. Home dude was a little feisty after this weekend. Talking a little smack with Mr. Hill. So I feel like he's going to be coming back wanting to mix things up. So I'm going to go with Grant Enfinger and the trucks. Xfinity, the monkey's got to get off Justin Allgaier's back at some point in time. He had another great car this weekend and got caught up in something right at the end. I really thought he was going to have a shot. And then Cup Series, thank you for letting me pick first. I'm taking the king of Kentucky, Martin Truex Jr.
Way to go on a limb there.
Yeah, I'm going on the thickest, strongest limb I can find on that one.
Well, I'll try to better you because when it comes to trucks, I'm going with Johnny Sauter. He's had a ton of bad luck since winning at Dover, whether it be something with a transmission at Kansas. Obviously, the Austin Hill incident where he ultimately got suspended for a race. I think he rebounds, gets the second win of the year. Xfinity, I'm not going outside the big three. I'm going Cole Custer. We've talked about him a lot on this podcast this year, and he's driven this year, and rightfully so, because obviously he's one of the best three drivers in the series on one of the best three teams. As far as Cup, I do think Truex is going to win, but I'm going to go Brad Keselowski because he's great at Kentucky. I mean,
he is good at Kentucky.
Him, Kyle, Truex, I would say those are the three best at Kentucky. He's won three times there before, I believe, off the top of my head. And he's had so he's got three wins this year, but he's only finished in the top 10 50% of the races. So I'd say he gets back to victory lane.
Now, I'm keeping my fingers crossed for Ben Rhodes, too. Man, he had a tough break last race out, broke before they even basically took the green flag. And Kentucky's his home state. So I'm keeping my fingers crossed that Ben gets a good rebound race at Kentucky.
Indeed. And I'm excited to be there. First time going to Kentucky. I saw someone with Kentucky license plates last week, and I said, hey, I'm going to Kentucky next week. What should I expect? And he's like, it's red, man. He asked if I like bourbon, because there's a lot of that there.
A lot of bourbon in Kentucky.
I'm excited to go, because like I said, I've never been. But now, fun time talking to you about Daytona. Yes, we recorded this about an hour after the race ended, because we were both fired up about the entire race, as we both thought it was a good race, though I truly believe we got robbed of 33 laps of insane racing there at the end. Again, no interview in this portion of the podcast. If you want to listen to Bob Levine, which I highly encourage it, go into the Apple Podcast, search Front Stretch. Bob spent 30 minutes with me on Tuesday morning via Skype. And talked about a lot of good stuff at Levine Family Racing. And we at Front Stretch thought it was better to split up the two instead of making this one long file because it was great content. We've got another big guest in store for next week, as we'll also recap a triple head weekend in Kentucky. But until then, we out.